Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tyler Brulé. On today's show, as Brussels-Zaventem Airport attempts to reopen, its own police have slammed on the brakes. We'll be asking how quickly can a city get back to business as usual after a terror attack. My guests are Andrew Tuck and Steve Bloomfield, and they'll be discussing these topics and many others on the show. Zaha Hadid, as architecture mourns the loss of a design great, will look ahead to what her legacy might be in the years to come. And as two London newspaper titles reshape both their editorial teams and news-gathering agendas, we'll be getting the lay of the land in publishing. Plus, our very own Robert Bound will be dropping by probably a little later in the program with a few cultural highlights. All that to come on Midori House with me, Tyler Brulé. We've just gone adrift of 1 minute past 1800 here in London. And I'm very happy to say that I have our very own editor, Andrew Tuck, is here. He's looking at today's lineup. He's also editing pages. He's got books going out the door. And not far behind him is his chief whip.
Hello.
Steve Bloomfield, our executive and foreign editor, is here as well. Gentlemen, we've slightly, we haven't thrown out the script this week, but this marks an interesting day because it's probably sort of the last traditional format that people have come to know Monocle 24 in its form over the last, four plus years, because Monday is going to be a bit of a relaunch for the station.
Yes, we have a kind of new sound starting with The Globalist, and someone's getting up very early to present that show.
Who would that be?
Me.
Okay, good.
I'm going to be
here. The way you were looking at me then, I thought, I wasn't aware of this.
I'm going to be here for The Globalist.
I'm going to be on a plane to Zurich, sorry. Otherwise, I would have taken that spot.
What's good is the evolution of our sound, the evolution of how this kind of radio station works is really fascinating. And we've been lucky to have amazing partners with us over these last 4 years. And we're ready to kind of take the next step up.
Absolutely. I was just in Studio 2 across the hallway listening to some fantastic work, which has been done not only by some of the men and women who created the musical sound that you hear for the station, Quiet Nights Orchestra. So they've you'll hear that there's some subtle retweaks to what happens at the top of the hour, but also Monorafa, who are a fantastic, another musical group out of Sweden we've been working with. They'll also be helping evolve our sound as well. And we've got a couple of interesting highlights on the horizon, which is very good. Steve, you look like you want to say something. Do you want to
You've got
28 minutes.
There's plenty of time.
27 minutes to talk and talk. Also, on Fridays, one thing that we're going to be doing with Midori House, we'll be bringing a few of our own voices. Oftentimes, people know the format, which will remain Mondays to Thursdays, but we'll be looking to bring in more of our own correspondents and voices on the Friday. A bit of a look ahead, and also a little bit of a week that was as well. And on that topic, as I was saying at the start of the show, it's been really two extraordinary weeks here, obviously. Off the attack, or off the back of the attacks in Brussels, we've been watching a very curious PR story, and a very unique one that has had to be not just played, of course, at a federal level, Steve, but also at a very micro level when you look at Brussels-Zaventem Airport. And so I'd probably say almost last weekend, off the back there, there was a sense of we're not quite sure when the airport is going to reopen. We moved into a new week this week, and we kicked off with, stay tuned, keep following our website, watch out for releases, because the airport might reopen tomorrow. And here we are, Friday evening. I was checking first thing this morning, and they said that the airport was probably going to open up partially. This evening. And now we're hearing, of course, that the police union is saying they really feel the airport is not safe for their staff. So to both of you, but Steve, I want to start with you, just your take on this, purely maybe from a media point of view and just managing this story as well.
Think back to the 7th of July 2005 and the bomb attacks in London on three tube stations, three tube train lines, one bus as well. And there was one decision that the Mayor of London had to take that day after those attacks, which was, when do you reopen the underground? And he very clearly said, we're reopening this straight away. Tomorrow morning, we can all get back on the tube and go back to work and start to get things back to normal. And that's what happened. And everyone sort of slightly gingerly got on the tube again, and it was okay. It was fine. And it has been, touch wood, fine ever since. That's obviously a little bit easier to do with an underground network, perhaps, than an airport. But it sends a really strong signal from the get-go that you are that your city is prepared to go back to normal, that it isn't going to give in. And I think the longer this goes on, obviously it's an airport, it is more difficult, but the longer it goes on without anyone really knowing for sure when it's going to reopen, I think that the weaker that message becomes.
Andrew, does this slightly re-underline part of the problem with Belgium, again, that we're seeing potentially factions and not everyone in lockstep? Of course, an airport has vested interests, and you know, and I'm sure at a federal level in Belgium, everyone wants to see this airport reopen, but perhaps not everyone's talking.
No, we know that there was a really key dislocation between many of the security services in Belgium, and that's one of the reasons people feel that these terrorists were able to kind of go about their business and not be stopped in the way that may have happened in other capitals. I agree with Steve, you know, it's great that you get something back up and running. It's slightly easier when it's a metro system and you can run lots of trains down different lines and one train is taken out of service.
And you don't have the same security issues. I mean, with an airport, it's already stacked against you in terms of all of the layers as well.
Yeah, and I think also just the sense of people coming into that hall and seeing bomb damage before you get on a plane, that's the last thing that people want to see. People are already in a heightened sense of kind of nervousness, many of them, when they travel anyway. So we know that people get panicky and there are scenes at airports and on planes. So I'm sure that the authorities are concerned about that. But it is a bit peculiar that the people in, you would imagine, in charge of security at the airport are saying, we don't feel secure, or we don't feel that the way that these checks are being set up that will cause additional lines and additional waiting time are going to be able to be managed in the space that we have at the airport.
Steve, last week I was talking to Matthias Dupfner. He's the CEO of Axel Springer, of course, one of Europe's biggest media groups. And he was saying, it's amazing if you look at just the problems in Berlin. Everyone is very familiar, of course, with this long, drawn-out problem to reopen Berlin Brandenburg Airport. And he was saying, will something be learned from all of this? Because here you have, you know, let's call it the capital of Europe, it really literally grinds to a halt because they do not have a functioning airport. And he said, will this, you know, is this a lesson for Berlin that maybe Tegel should be kept open because maybe you shouldn't put all of your eggs in one basket if you're a significant capital? And it's not just saying, do we have another runway? Of course, you know, many airports have, you know, smaller airfields for private aircraft, Air Force bases, et cetera. But you actually maybe need other terminals, et cetera. And do you think, you know, here we are in London, we've got 5+ airports, you know, to call on. You would say the same thing with New York, Washington, D.C. So the world's major cities do have backup. And I'm just wondering if that will be, yeah, it's a bit of a cautionary tale for other cities that are thinking, oh, let's move our airports far away, let's close down, you know, maybe these great airports we have in our city centres or at least, you know, not too far away.
There is something really to be said to having more than one airport for a variety of reasons, and one of those is, as you say, security. It's interesting, at the moment, earlier today we've been having a meeting about our June issue of the magazine, and in the past that's had our big transport survey, and if you go back to, I think, the 2013 edition of the transport survey, there's a big feature there on the new Berlin airport that we had exclusive access to, which we were promised would be open by the time the magazine actually came out. It's a good example of how even in the best planned of cities, things don't always work out.
I wondered here, the problem goes beyond the airport in a way. What's been fascinating over the last couple of weeks is, you know, there's also this really mismanaged narrative about catching people, who's caught, who they have in their custody, who they don't have in their custody, who is the third man in this picture, who is still potentially within the
city. Been asked of people who have been caught?
No, but exactly. And now, you know, do we believe that, you know, they suddenly have somebody who's, you know, a proper turncoat that handing over all the information they want? So that narrative hasn't been handed well. Then there's the kind of the local management of communities, which has been, you know, again, you just don't feel that they've either bitten the bullet to kind of decide this is the way ahead. They've had some kind of terrible kind of ad hoc demonstrations which have seemed to hijack what the story they wanted to tell as a city. And so I think that part of the unease for people travelling through Brussels is a sense that you don't know who's on the run. You don't even now believe the authorities within the city, let alone at the airport, have got a grip of what's going on. And the community cohesion feels like a bit of a disaster.
And you think back to following the Paris attack, when Brussels was shut down for several days and the army were on the streets and no one else was, and yet no one was caught then. And there was this sense from people in Brussels that they didn't feel as if their authorities, their representatives, really knew what they were doing and had a grip on the situation. And as you say, over the past 2 weeks, that's only been heightened.
Hmm. Do you think, of course, hard to look into a crystal ball on a Friday evening, especially when the bar trolley is already open at Midori House, but do you think that they're going to be able to get a grip on it? And Steve, do you think that there are a number of not just the spin doctors and the comms people in the room, but a real sort of sense of we have to get on top of this in Belgium?
There has, in their defence, been a little bit of leadership shown. I thought Charles Michel, the Prime Minister, has been very careful with his language. He hasn't gone down the route of his colleague in France, Manuel Valls, and talk about this being a war. His language has actually been quite good in terms of how he's dealt with that issue. And I think he has been sort of thrust to the fore more than perhaps a Belgian Prime Minister has been in the past. And it's possible that he can see what happens with this crisis and try and centralise a little bit more power. But, as we've said over the last few weeks, six governments, three regions, three languages, which don't correspond with the three
and
regions.
I agree with you. I don't know whether the language is right or effective. The only thing I would say for the casual person who doesn't have to go to Brussels, I wonder if you had a choice now. You could go via Schiphol or you could go via Brussels. You could spend the day in Brussels. You could spend the day in Amsterdam doing business. What would you choose at the moment? And I've got a feeling that people will think, do you know what? I'm not quite ready to go back. Whereas with Paris, in a way, maybe the language is misplaced. So it's not correct. If you come out tough, then people think, actually, I'm going to go back. I think they're on top of this, whether they are or aren't. I'm just not sure that the nicey-nicey rhetoric persuades people to come back to your city.
Wait, so, and just, sorry, Steve, but Andrew, because you think you want to actually hear the PM being a little bit more firm about things, saying we've got a handle on it because, and it's maybe it's not just a question, because I think one issue is, okay, do I get on a plane or a train to go there within the week? Or, okay, we're at the end of quarter one now, and maybe we have a board meeting as a company next week or in the next couple months thinking about the expansion of our Asian business. We're a big company sitting in Singapore or Hong Kong thinking about, we were going to put our headquarters in Brussels, like so many other companies. Maybe we have to look elsewhere. Is that one of the bigger problems as well? And if you don't hear, I'm not saying it has to be we're going to war language, but at the same time, that sense of we've got a handle on things, we have a plan.
Yes, certainly that thing. I think also Paris has benefited from the fact that it's Paris and it's a place that people have always wanted to go to, whereas Brussels has, let's be honest, never really had that cachet. But I think it's more the fact that it's having a grip on it and having a plan, whatever that plan is more important than sounding as if you don't really know what you're doing.
Mm. I want to move on because I think we're all newspaper men around the table. It's been a big week or a big couple of weeks, certainly in the world of publishing. The Independent was lights out at the back end of last week. 1 week on from the shuttering, Saturday, in fact, but pretty much 1 week on from the shuttering of the print edition of that newspaper. We've seen throughout the week a lot of happy talk about jobs for the Independent's website, and at the same time, a number of people who will be going over to what was its sister publication, I, which is a slimmed down, faster, more youthful version of the newspaper. It's been sold to another newspaper group in this country. And Andrew, I'll start with you. You had a very interesting observation at the start of the week, listening to one of the major morning shows here in the UK on the BBC, and said it was amazing the evaporation from the conversation suddenly.
Well, what's great for me as a snapshot of how this affects you if you don't have a print product is they were doing a roundup on another news show of the morning's headlines, and they rattled through all sorts of newspapers, including some rather small and obscure ones. And for the first time ever, I didn't hear the Independent mentioned. Now, they've obviously taken an editorial decision that they will not be reviewing the front pages of websites. So they're sticking with a newspaper roundup. And for them, a newspaper is something that comes out on a piece of paper. And that meant they had disappeared from that first bit of the day when you're thinking, what newspaper should I pick up today? What's the story I must read? And they were gone from that. Now, that is the bit that I don't think anybody quite has a grip on. Now, The Independent has been forced by circumstance, not through desire, to ditch its paper product first ahead of all its rivals. We know this is a conversation happening within other newspaper groups, within London, within other cities around the world. But I think a lot of people are going to be very hesitant to see what actually happens. Not to the number of clicks. Anybody can get the number of clicks, but your central position in the conversation of the day. And we know that here in the UK, for example, that morning roundup is quite important for being part of a political conversation, the business stories of the day. And once you've disappeared from that, then I think you have a problem, because you don't get in the advertising revenue, you don't get the key readers, you just get people clicking around looking at pictures of cats if you're not careful.
The other problem The Independent has is that it's all very well saying, oh, well, we've kept some of our key names and we're going online and you can still read all your favourites there. But you can't read all your favourites there, because they've mentioned three or four that have kept their jobs, of the big names that independent readers will know. Journalism costs money, and digital advertising doesn't bring in money. So therefore, if you want to do good journalism, you simply can't do it.
Especially, and we were talking about this at this very same time yesterday, Steve, that they're talking about, they've got a headcount of 75 at The Independent. So that's bundling in, I guess, everyone from, of course, editors and people on the IT team all the way through to accounting.
Yeah.
But even so, there's still a big headcount.
It is. And they'll have to pay some wages. Or, of course, they won't have to pay that much, because some of those staff will be on far lower salaries than their predecessors were, and no one so far has been able to, people talk about Vice and people talk about BuzzFeed, but those are two big advertising agencies and branding companies with a little news division plumped on top, which doesn't make money. TheIndependent.co.uk is going to really struggle to make money.
Something else which made news this week, well, two things that cropped up. One, which we sort of almost like squeaked out off the back of another story, and that is that Apple have shuttered their newsstand for iPad, which this just came through via another story on one of the trade websites earlier today. I mean, that's quite remarkable, isn't it, Andrew? That, of course, here you've got Big Apple, which, of course, has been talking up magazines on tablets. But as we know, when we've been courted by lots of other people who've wanted us to join in this tablet party, it's never sort of felt right to us. And somehow, the world's company with the highest valuation manages to close down something which they were promising, and many people were jumping on with, that this was going to be the future of the transition of print to digital.
Well, this came about because we saw a story about another magazine that's put out here in London, who had done a digital version of their magazine that they were distributing via Apple, but suddenly this whole element shut down and they decided there was no way for them to keep going. So what's interesting is you think about the money that was invested into that, and that, again, they're saying that they're not going to lose jobs or anything, but the money and time invested into that then just disappears. And I think that when people are talking about kind of a commitment to all these new digital platforms and how they're going to work for you, I think you have to be very well aware it's not a kind of a world that's just there permanently, just like any other thing, just like old-fashioned print. Things will come and go, so don't be too dependent on that as your distribution channel.
No, and Steve, earlier in the week as well, the UK Press Gazette also reported, and of course, because the Times and the Sunday Times, which have a bit of a bundled website, announced that they're going to move out of the world of breaking news, that they weren't going to be in ticker territory and updating every 5 seconds. Partly, as we know, because it costs money, and of course, it raises the question: is that the world that you need to be in as a newspaper and as a newspaper of record? So they're going for roughly, it sounds like, four editions a day. And so that's when it will be updated. And that, of course, plays to the strengths of analysis and many of those things that we know about already. Your take on that?
So there are two different versions. Let's ignore The Independent. There are two different versions of how to use the web as a newspaper that we've seen not just in the UK, but elsewhere. One is to go down the route of, say, The Guardian, and everything is free. It's updated all the time. You might go onto their website to see what the latest breaking news is. But this is a newspaper that announced just a few weeks ago it's getting rid of 250 people. It's losing £1 million a week. £1 million a week. Or you can take the route of The Times, which has seen its newspaper sales slip rather than slump over the past 5-10 years, and has actually managed to make some money by having a digital subscription. So you have to pay to read The Times online. And so they've decided that actually, you know, they don't want to chase the breaking news because they know that they've got a certain number of subscribers. It's in the tens of thousands of digital subscribers who pay to receive it on their iPad and on their phones every day. And for them, it makes sense to put out digital editions rather than be constantly updating it. And, you know, you've just got to look at which of those two companies is not losing £1 million a day.
Mm. Andrew, just before we go to the break, do you think that's actually a sound way to go? They seem to be leading the way, at least within the English-speaking world, from what I can see, with this type of move.
I think it's good for journalism. I think in the sense that they've said to their journalists, here are the deadlines, you'll be filing for these times, don't miss them. So people have a kind of a chance to be a little bit more contemplative and analytical in what they file. And I think that you will see that represented in what is made available. My only concern is I think that world has become such a thing, a beast of its own. I don't know that many people are committed to one brand. Most people are rather promiscuous with their news intake, and they may find that some people who were depending on them all the time do go elsewhere. But I think it's a good thing for journalism.
You are listening to Midori House on a Friday here on Monocle 24. We are going to have a very short break. When we come back, our Robert Bound will be joining us in the studio.
Our ideas-packed Entrepreneur's Guide. The Design Directory for people who want to build a better home. The Style Guide for getting to grips with the business of looking good. The Soft Power Survey. The Travel Top 50. Monocle magazine has a superlative lineup of survey reports and investigations coming your way. And to make sure that you never miss an issue, you just need to do one thing. Become a Monocle subscriber. Not only will you get all of this great journalism, you'll also have free access to our full archive of stories online, receive invites to subscriber events around the world, and be sent a free gift too. Go to monocle.com/subscribe to join us today.
It is just gone 2022 in Helsinki, 1822 in Porto. It is 1323 now, in fact, if you are listening in Toronto. And you are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're broadcasting from Midori House. I'm happy to say that our editor, Andrew Tuck, is here. Steve Blumenfield, our executive and foreign editor. And Robert Bound, our culture editor, has just miraculously appeared at this lovely table.
Out of the smoke. I heard you talking in the earlier part of the show about a tablet party, and I thought I'd better turn up. this is the show that's trying to get us into the weekend, isn't it?
It
at
is.
At least in certain territories.
It is.
And I wanted to tell you this afternoon about Victoria. It comes out in the UK, the US, and across Europe. Have you seen Run Lola Run, Sebastian Schipper's amazing kind of Euro thriller? It was 4 or 5 years ago. Red-headed girl running through Berlin. This is
who later became rather famous for, of course, being No, what was it?
Is it Famke Janssen?
No,
is it
Famke Janssen?
I don't know whether it is Famke Janssen. I think the more we say Famke Janssen, the less sense it makes.
Everyone Famke Janssen.
Have you got a recipe for Famke Janssen? I was going to make some tonight at home.
we'll come back to this. In the meantime, tell us about the film, Rob.
So, Victoria, there's been a lot of buzz about this movie. Screenings kind of happened. Press screenings happened very late for this because it sort of kicked off a lot of internet buzz about it because it's all done in one take. A la Birdman.
But this is actually done in one take.
But this is actually done in one take.
Unlike Birdman.
So this is an interesting. I've got a stat on this, which I actually nicked from the press release, Sebastian Schipper
turned
on the cameras.
Sorry, late breaking news.
Yeah?
Franka Potente.
Famke Potente.
Because she was in the Bourne Identity. That was it.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Franka.
Yeah.
Yeah, Janssen,
but
Potente.
You must give me the recipe for that jam or whatever.
Well, I can sort you with your Potente.
Sebastian Schipper and his cinematographer.
Have you patented recently?
This is going to happen, isn't it?
I know.
Victoria's going to stay in the Victoria's going to stay on the cutting room floor. I can see. Do you want to have a statistic about how to do a shot, how to do a movie in one take? You turn on the cameras at 4:40 a.m. on April the 27th, and you run without interruption for 134 minutes until 6:54 a.m. They did this 3 days in a row, and they took the third cut. They did three of these one take cuts.
Wow!
And that is the movie that you see before you, and it is absolutely astonishing. It's got a lot of it's a thriller, which is great, which is easily likable, but it kind of messes around with lots of the tropes of that genre. It's got a very strong female central character, and it is shocking and beguiling and fantastic. It's got good club scenes, good nude scenes, and a lot of it's desperately thrilling and weird, and it's quite, you kind of need a stiff drink when you walk out of the auditorium.
We've got one for you, Rob,
and thank you very much, Chin Chin.
Stiff something after the nude scenes. Andrew, what makes a good nude scene?
Oh God, what makes a good nude scene?
If it happens in Andrew's house.
If it involves me.
Yeah, okay. What a selfish editor he is.
Exactly. The nude scene as good or as weird as the one in Anomalisa?
It's not that weird. It's actually very joyful, the one.
That's a good news. A joyful
good. It's a sunrise. It's a naked rave at sunrise, which is, I think, we can all relate to. Come on, we were all going to the Vienna Conference.
We were all in the July August story meeting a little earlier. What else, Rob? What else do you have?
Well, also today sees the release of Pet Shop Boys. I don't know. Is it their? I think it's their 13th LP. It's called Super. It lives up to its name. It's absolutely fantastic. I think they must be the most consistently brilliant and well-reviewed duo, I mean, of any description in the world. The Gilbert and George of pop are back, as ever, and in fine voice, in fine form. This one's kind of clubby and nice. Their last album was a little bit quiet and mournful.
They've both stayed in character for all these years. That is the amazing thing.
Yeah, and I always just feel slightly sorry for Chris Lowe, the keyboard player and singer, because he's always got the worst of the two bad hats.
Exactly.
Right? I had dinner with Neil Tennant.
Sorry,
that's a story for another time.
We'll save that for next week.
I think that's after the second drink, Andy. You can tell us about that.
There are no nude scenes.
Jenna, before we go, and I'm going to try to make a tack change on that one before we get there. Of course, news, again, around this time yesterday, really flashed up around the world. Zaha Hadid died of a heart attack in Florida yesterday, was there for treatment for bronchitis. It was, it took me... I think it took all of us by shock in this office. We talk about urbanism, we talk about the built environment all the time, whether it's on this outlet, and certainly it's been a defining piece for the magazine. Andrew, just legacy and how you think Zaha will be remembered, and also someone who is at a very interesting part of her career at 65, you know, not exactly young, but we think many architects actually rather young, given, of course, her profile, Pritzker Prize winning. What do we think happens next? You think of the firm and how this endures?
Well, I've got a feeling the firm will be okay, actually. I think there is a legacy that she will leave behind in her work and her ambition and her take. Through here at Monocle 24, we've met many of the other architects that work at the practice. They've come here to talk on various shows. She has an extraordinary group of talented people who work with her. I think for her, the strange thing was it was kind of coming good in some ways, kind of not in other ways. She'd been challenged in Tokyo over her project there. Many of the things that she wanted to get built didn't get built, but she had begun to find a place. And we're not always agreeing it, but she had begun to find her place.
Steve?
I thought she was incredible. But she was one of those architects who would not really necessarily give up much when it came to working with a local population, a local community. But her work is stunning and it's utterly recognisable.
And I'd say as well, utterly recognisable. Like any great artist or architect, you could tell one of her buildings from a mile away or from space. And also it kind of tells you about the pace of life of this architect. Having interviewed a couple of people on the sites of plots they've got plans to design, and having racing from one plane to one meeting to one interview, this is perhaps part of Zaha Hadid's sad demise, but fantastic. And glad also that she got such a reputation from where she was from and being a woman as well.
Rob Bound, Steve Bloomfield, Andrew Tuck. We're going to have to leave it there. That's all for this edition of Midori House. Today's show is produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Charlie Young, and our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Carlotta Ribello is here next with some great music, and of course, the menu is here at 1900 London time. But for me, Tyler Brulé, have a very, very good weekend. Goodbye.